Min campus alihor, miai Karsten Schwine. Akoma program iħor, fi sensi jela minn kampus għal-iħor, miħaj Karsten Xwire, kien jirċema l-intervista li dejjem nagħmel ma' xi ħadd mid-dinja tal-Akkademja jew relatat ma' d-dinja tal-Akkademja, se tkun ma' Dr. Annette Nodin. Minn kun jumma stess ġa forsi tistgħu tieħdu sensazzjoni tal-dinja Franċiża li hija wkoll hija parti minna, però mhux biss fil-fatt l-esperjenza tagħna żviluppat ħafna in-naħa l-oħra tal-baħar illi jaqsam il-Franza mir-Renju Unit u fil-fatt ħafna mix-xogħol tagħha huwa marbut proprju mal-Ingilterra. Storja interessanti, marbuta anke b'ħafna aneddoti fuq livell ta' familja, fuq livell ta' żvilupp personali, u għalhekk hija flimkien nisimgħu l-intervista ma' Dr. Annette Nodin. Welcome back, our listeners, to Min Campus Alihor here on Campus FM. You might be listening directly on radio, 103.7 FM or DAB, and also through our website where the podcast is always available and also available to everyone around the world. From my introduction, listeners have already been introduced to Annette Nodin. Annette, I welcome you to the show. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
In preparing for this program, we sort of caught up a little bit because it's been a number of years, let's leave it at that, since we last met during our studies at Warwick University in the UK. Suffice it to say, maybe that sort of Tony Blair was just being elected for the third time at the time, I remember.
That's
quite a while ago. But this program, as you know, focuses a little bit on the career path or sort of the career development of a person, keeping in mind our listeners are people, university colleagues, but also students. So these type of narratives, these type of stories and experiences can really sort of help open up experiences and possibly share both sort of fun, interesting stories, but also maybe sometimes the going gets tough. And invariably with the professional side, we also speak a little bit about the personal side. So I think my first question to you, like to so many other guests on this show, is where, if you had to go back, sort of, where do you feel your first early steps in what eventually started to turn out into being a career path start off from?
Well, that's an obvious and interesting question. I think it's straightforward. It's just through education, really. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's anything more unusual than that. I think it's following through a process of, you know, being in school and the next step and the next step and going to university and then following on from the opportunities that came from that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because maybe to some people, possibly ourselves, possibly even many of our listeners, It might sound so fairly the road to follow. But then sometimes you come across people, and there have been people on this show. In fact, the previous guest on the series, a Maltese professor on education living in Canada, John Portelli, speaks about sort of the dropouts and pushouts within the education system. And he identifies very much with that. But somehow education remains very much at the core of what may be a really good way of progressing, of sort of even settling down personally and knowing which route to take. And I know you're a mother, so maybe we'll come down to that later as well. So you must be sort of living that again vicariously and also directly as a parent. So looking back, you'd say sort of in that area, definitely education was an important route.
Oh, absolutely, definitely, yeah. And I mean, it's difficult for me to pinpoint what is significant in terms of where I'm sitting now and where my career is at now. Mm. And obviously, we'll come to that in a moment, because I've kind of had two careers. I see a path through that, and probably we'll discuss that. But they do, on the surface, look distinctively different. And so the first part of my working life is very much a follow through from my educational experience. The second part is then a follow through from that, if you like, but it doesn't link very obviously to what I did, you know, when I was 18, 19, 20 in terms of my education.
Yes. To sort of cover the period up till then. So up till those choices when you were an adult, and that's my 18, 19, started sort of deciding possibly even more for yourself in many areas. Were choices you were making already at that age fundamental in what you did later? Again, some people say, yes, fairly simple, fairly straightforward. And others say, absolutely not. I went into certain areas and then just almost on a whim sometimes took off into another direction. And that's where I found more myself. How was it in your case?
It is interesting, certainly with hindsight. I think you can start to create a kind of narrative. And, you know, just very briefly, so for your listeners who may not be able to hear this, but I am actually French. And, you know, I grew up in France and went to primary school in France. And, but my father's French, and I have French siblings, and my mother, who was his second wife, is British, and I have just one sibling who, like me, is French and English. So there's sort of six brothers and sisters, and then another two and eight in total. I'm the seventh of eight. And my mother very much wanted us to go to a UK school, but we didn't learn English until we effectively were sort of shipped off to, literally shipped off to Northern England, to an area called Yorkshire, which I don't know if you visited, but it's actually very beautiful. And it's actually where my sister and my mother live now. And we were shipped off to boarding school, me first, and she followed the following year. And my mother had always been keen on art and certainly encouraged us to do art. And then when I went to school in Yorkshire and I was learning English, you know, I was very much just a little French girl. It was quite a challenge, as you might imagine. And I suppose having some skills in art meant that I could at least shine in one thing. It was something that I could do, and I didn't need to understand too much of what was going on, as long as I got the gist of the painting we were supposed to do. That's one thing, right? And I wasn't particularly sporty or anything like that, so you know, this is the one thing I could do. So being at the kind of school I was at, it was a Quaker boarding school, mixed with boys and girls, with, you know, some very nice facilities. My mother's Quaker, so we were there on on a bursary. So it's not a Harry Potter kind of, you know, not super privileged, but a fee paying school. So in a UK context, we would still see that as relatively kind of privileged. And the Quaker element meant that you know, you could be encouraged if you were academic, but no mm-hmm. one was too worried about it. And there was a lot of really good arts facilities there, and, you know, really nice teachers as we got older would say, for the weekend, do you want the keys to the textile room, or do you want the keys to the art room? So there was that kind of, okay, you know, on Saturday, I'm just going to lock myself in the art room and with a couple of friends maybe, and we'll just make a load of batik or something like that. So certainly the kind of artistic path was the seeds were there from my mother probably, and then that very much continued, and a combination of access to roof facilities and also then this sense that, you know, because English wasn't my first language, this was something that I could thrive at. And I did go on to do A-level art and continue in that area. So.
Indeed, indeed. And then we'll come to it, and also the art in general and also the cultural perspective played a big role later on. But this is really interesting, the way, even the way you're reflecting on it. It's almost, and this is common to many people, even on this show, unless you stop and think about how maybe, as you said, things might have actually a narrative through them. Looking back with hindsight, you might really sort of have forgotten a few connections or really sort of integrating them so much in your life story that you don't have time to do that, unless maybe you're going through an album with family members and going through the milestones. But what you said as well about sort of there being a couple of elements from the family and then going on into the school and the, I guess with the Quaker community, having that feeling of not only going to school, clocking in, clocking out, but actually something which went into as well the weekends, as you said, and maybe a whole formation in terms of how one also took to expressing oneself, in spite of the fact that English was not at that point your first language.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I did, because I stayed for a whole year, so I would say by the time I was in my second year at school, I effectively swapped languages, so I kind of couldn't really remember French very well and just learned English. So I never learned to translate, really. I just learned English as a new language in the way that a baby learns, you know. And I've always found translating really, really difficult. So I can speak French now, but when people say, you know, why don't you go and teach in France or do other things in France, I always say, well, I speak like a 10-year-old, you know. So, yes, it kind of sounds fluent if I go into a boulangerie and I ask for a croissant or something. But in fact, you know, I couldn't, it would be very difficult for me to lecture in French, for instance, and to speak professionally in French. So it was interesting to sort of swap languages in that way.
The shift without sort of somehow going back and forth and weaving your way through more than one language is really interesting. It's reminding me of something I read recently. On Lydia Davis, the writer and translator, and her experience is very different because she sort of goes into the background and the roots of even languages she doesn't speak and isn't able really to write in. But she goes through this exercise, but she relates her story, including episodes which remind me of yours and of other people even on this show. But somehow the new language you are sort of parachuted into if you travel and go to school at an early age in a completely different setup, can sometimes feel a bit like a labyrinth, like a maze or simply a blank wall you somehow have to get through. So it's really interesting that in your case, you had the means, the artistic means, the creative means to wiggle your way in and then actually take on the English language.
Yeah. And I had an additional challenge, which I didn't realize, in fact, until I went to, as a mature student, went to the University of Warwick, which was when we met, which must be about 17 years ago.
That is right.
Sorry to put a figure
on it. You said it.
But it's only at that point that I had the appropriate test, but I didn't realize that I'm dyslexic. And it turns out I'm severely dyslexic. And so when I was at school, I assumed that the difficulties I had in doing geography or history or other subjects was because I'd learned English late. And so, but actually, by the time I was 14, 15, really, I was pretty fluent in English. And I still had some academic challenges. And again, that took me close to art, because that was an area that I could thrive in. I didn't necessarily need to be as good at, you know, my grammar, my writing didn't need to be as good. My reading and writing skills had to be there, but not to the same extent. But that only came through for me much later. And by which time, they said, I pretty much found all the ways round my dyslexia, and was obviously doing an MA anyhow. So it's kind of interesting how that could have also pushed this sense of the creative subjects and working in the visual arts seemed particularly relevant and appropriate for me as a space worker.
That's really interesting as well, because in another series, I've spoken with people from the field of people with learning difficulties, and also on the station there are many such discussions, even through the department of social well-being, and it's interesting because there are so many strategies that sometimes planned out, sometimes rather impromptu, as in your case, to go about tackling different ways in which people learn. So again, in your case, it's interesting how sort of a little bit, again, with hindsight, you realized that, certain difficulties and certain subjects were not just down to the language learning at a later stage, but somehow, again, art, creativity, artistic expression, and your skill, I guess, developed ways of seeing you through.
Exactly. The only thing I would say, and because I think, you know, the audience for this, who, you know, they might include students who are dyslexic, is that there was real value for me even later on in life to actually have a diagnosis, because although I'd worked through many of the practical ways of you know, working in a context that tends to be a disadvantage for anybody who's dyslexic, as in, you know, academic work. There's something about pinning it down that is both a real relief. It's like, oh, okay, great. Somebody can actually label this thing that just feels like it's been a struggle for a long time.
Okay.
And so there's a real relief that comes with that, I think. And then also there is a sense of understanding why it is that you go around a particular problem in a particular way, because you know that you're addressing the fact that that's going to be the easiest way for you to do things. And then there's other things that come from it, which is that you're able to just say, no, I can't do that, or I don't want to do that, or I don't want to do it that way, because you know that it's going to be to your disadvantage, or it's going to not be easy for you to do. So, I will not read a long paper overnight for my boss. I'll say, you need to give me 2 days to do that. Simple things like that, that just allow you to, with some level of confidence, say, I can do this, I can do that, but I can't do that, and I want to do that in this particular way.
And as you said, sort of finding your way and then making it clear to yourself and to others, especially in an education environment or a work environment, that there are particular ways in which you can do the same thing, do it well, but working, as you said, to your strengths and to your advantages. And it's really interesting, the way you described pinning something down, or even labeling it. Those were the words used. Whereas sort of many times I hear those words used in a negative way, in a negative context and with a negative connotation, because people indeed can get labeled because of something they is part of their life, part of their learning curve. But in your case, it's interesting how you expressed it, which is sort of knowing that there are certain realities which characterize us, can either box us in, or else can actually open these boxes up. And in your case, it's very much a case of the second one.
Yeah, I try to make it work in that way. I suppose it's trying to turn this into not feeling like a victim of, you know, something called dyslexia, because it's not an illness, you know, it's something that is part of your character. And really, it doesn't mean that you lack any intelligence or anything like that. It just means that your brain functions in a different way. And the setup of most academic kinds of activities, you know, which your students will be involved in, is that it tends to be testing our brains in ways that are particularly challenging for anybody who is dyslexic. And so it's about sort of seeing, well, how can I navigate that space? But then also, how can the kind of brain that I have, and actually there's no such thing as dyslexia, there's each individual's form of dyslexia. So understanding yourself in that way is very helpful. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, it is about seeing, well, what is it that's kind of positive about the ways in which I work, which allow me to do certain things, which other people find really challenging and other people can't do. And, you know, yes, it's more likely often that you're not necessarily kind of tested to do that. There isn't a qualification that gets you a brilliant grade for, you know, thinking in ways that are less linear, maybe. But sometimes there is, you know, sometimes some courses, some design and arts and creative courses, or some aspects of business planning when you need to think in more innovative ways, when you need to do problem solving, which a lot of students need to try and, you know, need to adopt these kinds of skills in many different areas of work, whether it's engineering or fine art. That's where it may be that you can really push the facility that you have, and you can use it really positively. Yeah. So it's maybe something to be celebrated rather than.
That's right. That's right. And the way you're describing it really makes it so. Sometimes again, one listens to lots of discussions or exposes oneself to material about dyslexia, what it is, and how we can relate to it. Or how it's sort of somehow is part and parcel of many community members and therefore of society at large. But having it through a story, through a personal story, through a narrative like this, I think it has a particular appeal to it. It's definitely appealing to me, and I guess even our listeners will, as you said, even those who are dyslexic will somehow relate and have their own experiences to possibly narrate like this as well in some other context. Annette, we're already making lots of headway in this program. So let's leave this first part, which was really, really interesting with the topics you already opened up, to catch our breath and have a first musical break like everyone else. You're entitled to two tracks. Some people even sneak another one in. But we've got two tracks prepared for our listeners today. So do you want to tell us about the first one we're going to listen to and why you've chosen it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it has been difficult, many people have said. But I decided to choose a Beatles track, which is the one, I think it's written by John Lennon, and it's called All You Need Is Love. And there's two reasons for choosing All You Need Is Love and for choosing the Beatles. As I said earlier, my mother's originally from the UK, and she's from Liverpool, which, as you know, is where the Beatles are from. And I don't live in Liverpool. I live in the centre of England in a city called Birmingham, which is where I work at the university, at Birmingham City University. But strangely, I met my husband here, and strangely, he's from Liverpool, from the area really nearby where my mother lives. So just a strange coincidence. And when we got married, we decided to get married in Liverpool. So I got all my French family, my many brothers and sisters and their wives and children and so on, to come over to Liverpool. And once we were married, the track that we played was All You Need Is Love. So it is on a personal note that I've chosen this, but it's also kind of about geography and kind of about where I come from as well.
It's true. A really happy coincidence of place coming together. So let's listen to this.
Sing the cup. be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time.
That was a really good tune to listen to. The Beatles are always the Beatles. As I was telling you, Annette, before, my daughter, she's 11 now, and she's really getting into them and the period of music around, as you said, Liverpool, and sort of really upbeat moment in the history of recent music, of contemporary music and modern music. On a popular level. But in the first part, Annette, my guest today on the show is Annette Nodam, speaking to me from Birmingham, as you said, Birmingham City University, and that way sort of we're connecting our campuses between Malta and the UK in this case, but you also sort of extended your geographical context, including the French background, your French background, your French family. We come to the second part, and therefore we've moved on. So we covered sort of early years, and now we're looking a bit more maybe at your sort of more conscious decisions in the field of academia, of training, of starting off these two careers which you described, which somehow maybe again with hindsight one can reconnect. So we come now to the age of late teens, early 20s. So what happens then?
So once I've done in the UK, we do A levels, and then if you're interested in studying art, or back then when I was doing it, which is in the early 1990s, course in art and design, which was a one-year course, which is a way of saying, well, which aspect of art are you interested in? You know, is it kind of the fine arts, painting, sculpture and so on? Or is it jewellery or graphic design or theatre or something like that? So I did, my aunt lived in Oxford at the time, so I did a foundation course in Oxford.
Okay.
And I lived with her for a year. Which led to a degree, which was at the time at Birmingham, it was called Birmingham Polytechnic at the time, and that was a degree, so a three-year course in textile, it was actually fashion and textile design. I subsequently stayed after the third year because it was a case of a panic, you know, what do you do with a textile degree?
Okay.
So I stayed on another year and did an MA in textiles. Mm-hmm. And I actually specialized in embroidery, mainly because, I mean, embroidery brings for many people connotations of some kind of handicraft and
that's right.
Very domestic. It wasn't the case for me. For me, embroidery was about being more kind of artistic than you might be if you were doing textile courses like weaving, which is very structured, very mathematical. Printed textiles, which tends to be about repeat patterns and so on. Whereas embroidery had a kind of looseness and a closeness to being artistic. And I also used industrial machinery and some aspects of computerized machinery. So I was able to take the subject into kind of different areas. And in my MA, I was also able to go to Italy for 3 months, to Milan.
Okay.
Which was a fantastic exchange, and I would always encourage, you know, whether it's my daughter or students, to take these opportunities to go and study elsewhere. So, you know, opening up to other cultures, learning about the visual language of other cultures and kind of branching out into different areas, experimenting, all that kind of thing in a way describes or characterize those in the end 5 years of study, because there's the foundation, the 3 years degree, and then the fourth year, if you like, of doing an MA, after which I had to think about what I would do seriously.
Yes, yes. In fact, what you describe is really familiar to me, but also to many other people who've been on the show and so many of our listeners, be they students or people, so maybe lecturers or work somehow in the education field. Because sort of one gets into something and it grows on them and one does well. But somehow 2-3 years pass and then sometimes you end up thinking whether that's it and one needs to sort of go back into the real world and possibly even leave behind the experiences gained through the education process. Or whether one can prolong a bit and maybe add on a year or two and do something else, do a sort of post, studies. And it's such a dilemma sometimes because, if one starts to look at where will one apply one's education in the world of employment and work, it's not easy. And sometimes it doesn't always lead to successful outcomes.
That's right. And I was at university at a time which is very different from now, when we hardly talked about what kind of job do you want.
Okay.
People just got on with their artistic kind of practices. And there was very little support or very little initiatives within the university to talk about careers. So, you know, it was a case of you kind of drop off a cliff at the end. And I pretty much did, actually. I had some part-time work working in a pizza, not a very nice, you know, very large company that makes pizzas. And I ended up, after an MA, you know, very overqualified person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, working full-time in a pizza restaurant, making my way up to the dizzy heights of being buffet manageress, you know. At which point I actually handed in my notice with nothing to go to because I just thought, this is crazy. I've studied so long. I really enjoyed what I was doing. I have no idea what the opportunities are, but it cannot be buffet manageress at a horrible American pizza kind of place.
Yes. You know? Yes. The story you're telling is so widespread. Even today we hear a lot about young people who may be overqualified, people who may be not even be that young anymore, but have degrees, a number of degrees, possibly even attain doctoral level, but somehow do not find their place and do not find a match between their experience, their skills, and what the work environment can offer. And we know with the COVID pandemic, certain structural difficulties have even been exposed even more.
That's right. It's very difficult, and I think it's a real challenge because it does put many people off working in the arts and creative industries unless they have some kind of financial backup, which then means that we're selecting out a whole group of people to contribute to, you know, our cultural and creative culture and economy, and that's a real shame. I mean, I guess that I was lucky in the sense that I didn't necessarily have money behind me, but I felt I had a certain resilience inside me to be able to do that thing of handing my notice, and I just knew that I would pick up bits here and there, and indeed that's what I did. So it was little step by step where, you know, I did have to in fact go back and work in a cafe, but it was in an artistic environment in a new building that had just been set up, you know, one of these old factories that gets kind of renovated. In our case, it was I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with the idea of custard, which is, you know, like a sauce that we use, so it was Bird's Eye Custard Factory in Birmingham, which was changed into artistic studios. They had a cafe, so working in the cafe there meant I was already meeting a whole different range of people. Before you know it, you're having a conversation about an opportunity to exhibit some of the work I'd done on my MA, and then an opportunity to pay for a small studio, unheated, very cold, but very cheap. And then one thing leads to the next, and you get a bit of lecturing work. And so then you get into a few years in my mid-20s where I'm essentially building up some level of contacts, confidence, earning a little bit more money, even if it's, you know, one day a week teaching on an Art Foundation course, which I did, or, you know, 2 days a week working on my textile work and going from exhibiting my work, which doesn't earn you any money, to thinking, well, actually, could I make a product here? Yes. And could this be kind of batch produced? And is there a market for that? And that essentially leads me into the first part of my proper kind of career, if you like.
That's right. Before we delve into that and come to the last part of the program, we do, with about 15 minutes to go, really, in our conversation, let's pause for the second time and again give ourselves a musical boost. I know before starting the program, we said, okay, let's have sort of a bit of retro nostalgia, which is, however, evergreen, always present. But now we're going to go into very, very recent vibes. So what are we going to listen to now and why?
Well, it's not even so recent for your much younger listeners.
That's true. That's true.
I thought, you know, it's so difficult to choose, but I'm going to choose a track by Beyoncé because I'm very fond of female singer-songwriters. I'm very fond of R&B and soul, and the particular track is Halo. And it kind of allows me to say something about work-life balance. I mean, it actually takes me into a period when I would have had my daughter by then. And I remember listening to Halo, which is a very uplifting song, when I was at the gym quite often. And I think when you're balancing a lot as a young mother of work, and, you know, motherhood, and trying to look after yourself, going to the gym, it's one of those songs that can just take you into a completely different space where you're just you, yourself, you're just in your own head for a while. And you need that break sometimes. And, you know, we might talk about it again afterwards, but a kind of work-life balance is something that's very important to me. So in some ways, it just simply symbolizes that. But I do like the song, and I do like the
Very good. I'm sure our listeners will too. So let's listen to it.
Remember those walls I built? Well, baby, they're tumbling down. And they didn't even put up a fight. They didn't even make a sound. I found a way to let you in, but I never really had a doubt. got my angel now. It's like I've been awakened. Every rule I had you breaking. It's the risk that I'm taking. I ain't never gonna shut you out.
So indeed, Annette Nodam, my guest on today's Mincampo Salihor, was right about the uplift we got from listening to that track, but also to the sort of sometimes not hidden meanings, but more other meanings and other reasons why sometimes certain tracks, certain pieces of music stick with us. And somehow maybe when we cast our minds back, realize that they symbolized certain moments in time, in your case, and it was very much of this work-life balance and trying to sort of keep things going, both professionally but also personally. So we're in the last part of our program today, Mincampo Salihor, as I said, with my guest, Annette Nodam, speaking to me from Birmingham. You've taken us through a lot in a very short time. And the narration is very interesting, because one thing, as you said at the beginning of the program, with hindsight, seems to lead to the next. If we move forward now, you've taken us through personal development, education, family, travel, and also the artistic element. You somehow started even sort of having more of value in itself, because it also allowed you to grow and to develop even socially in your community. What came next?
Well, you know, once I was able to get started with doing some textile work, then, you know, I had one of those odd meetings with somebody. In fact, we recalled this meeting not long ago, myself and this guy called Pete, where I was in a laundrette doing my washing and, you know, I met somebody who was trying to sort out his sheets, and we ended up talking about what we each did, and that gave me an opportunity opportunity to take advantage of a European-funded program that he was running, which was to help people set up in business. And so I was able to set up a textile business and do this kind of batch production, and did that for a good sort of 6-7 years. So sometimes doing design work, sometimes mostly wholesaling to, I mean, maybe your listeners have heard of stores like Liberty in London and Harvey Nichols, and selling to some stores in New York and San Francisco, to stores in Japan also. So small batch production, but some quite nice names, you know, and I would be in Elle Decoration and in Sunday magazines and things like that.
But, so really plugging into the market.
Yeah.
Starting off in a laundrette, the benefits of
communal
washing.
It's not a route necessarily, but I suppose it's once you want something like that happens, it's kind of what you make of it. And it was timing. It was kind of luck and timing. But I mean, I did get to a point where, you know, this work was quite fun, but it was a lot of hard work and I wasn't making very much money necessarily. And I did get to a point in my sort of late 20s when I just thought, hang on, if I get to a point where I want to have a family, how's this going to work? Because this business is, the brand is me, it's my name. That's the name of the business. You know, everybody knows me. I did employ people and I had outworkers and things like that, but it never kind of, it was just really difficult to see how you could make it work. And then I decided...
You were your own capital, basically, so... Yeah.
And what I decided, what I realized that in that period of time, I'd learned a lot. I'd learned skills about managing myself. I'd learned skills about business. I'd learned about creative businesses. And I'd also found that the person who'd originally helped me set up in business, Peter Taylor, was running all sorts of programs connected to universities often to help other creatives in business. And that our local authority, our local agencies in the arts and the creative sectors were engaging in various programs that would help creatives. So I essentially switched everything that I'd learned into being a consultant to help others do that. Firstly, focusing a little bit more on the areas that I knew something about, which was more kind of visual arts and textiles, but actually then just kind of branching across the creative industries and the arts kind of scene. So I was able to do, you know, applications for funding, for festivals, for a jewelry festival, which was still going until a couple of years ago. And, you know, evaluations for projects or project managements of other kinds. So I was able to start to earn a living, a slightly better living as a creative industries consultant for a couple of years. And that's really what led me to think about the MA at Warwick in cultural policy, because then I started to think, actually, this is all fine, but I really want to do some, you know, do this better and have much better knowledge generally of the cultural sector and be better at researching also.
And somehow, since you had already started off in this field of providing consultancy services for other people entering the field, having that year at the University of Warwick was formative, but also very, very valuable in terms of use, because you could apply a lot of
I really could apply it, because I actually did it in 2 years, because I was part-time. So I was working...
Yes.
I was working 2 days a week on a European-funded project, doing business training for creative businesses and so on. I had my young daughter, who was between the age of 2 and 4 when I was with the MA. So I was balancing that, listening to Beyonce, to try and, you know, to...
Get on top of things.
Get away from everything, and doing the MA. And I was very lucky, because relatively shortly after the MA, I had decided that I would only have one child, and I decided that because of that, I would be able to kind of travel around Europe. And just before I went off on my travels with her, just the two of us, and before I did that, a job came up at what is now Birmingham City University to run an MA in media and creative enterprise. So it had kind of been the training that I'd been doing, but turning that into an academic qualification, and having just finished one academic qualification at Warwick, I was in a relatively good position. So I got the job. I said, I can't start now because I'm going around Europe with my 4 year old. I think just before she was four, she was free on Interrail or something.
And maybe not having started yet of the school.
Exactly.
Or the school system.
So I took full advantage of that, had a great time. My husband met us every so often.
Very good.
Join us in Italy and, you know, and then we came back, and then I've been at the same university since. But I've been very lucky because one of the things that my current university, Birmingham City University, enabled me to do was actually to go back to the people we know at Warwick and the Centre for Cultural Policy Studies. And my university paid for me to do my PhD with Chris Bilton, who you know from Warwick. So that, again, I was a part-time student, so working 3 or 4 days a week at my university. My daughter was growing up by then, I mean, still needing her mom, so, you know, it still has, those challenges were definitely there. But I was able to progress as an academic as a result of doing a PhD. And, you know, I did it in 5.5 years. So that's quite good for somebody doing it part time and working full time. But at the same time, the slightly slower pace is quite good for also reflecting and thinking.
Yes. It allows you to absorb and test out and see change over a number of years. And in your case as well, especially because you're nearing the end of our interview. It's interesting, like other people on this series, I'm not aiming from the start to become an academic, but rather sort of it happens. You realize you're good at it. You have lots to give back to the sector. You keep learning while you're lecturing and while you're researching and having the opportunity to be involved even in projects. So a practical kind of academic approach. And somehow seeing that develop step by step, even in terms of collaborations between universities, between institutions, between funds. So that's a great example. We're down to the last couple of minutes, Annette. And I know you wanted to come back to the work-life balance point, which we have more than once. But I think looking back now, and maybe looking a little bit ahead, where do you see your next steps going?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is interesting because I'm not a super ambitious person, so I'm not trying to be a head of this or a dean or anything like that. But I do find that I always want to stay curious. And I, you know, my first role was as the course director of an MA, and it's changed enormously since then. You know, I'm now associate professor for learning and teaching, so I now support other academics in their learning and teaching as well as continuing my research. And you're right, I also do have that one foot in practice and that kind of nod to being practical and quite grounded in that way. But the PhD gives me that kind of academic context, which makes me feel like I deserve my place in academia. So on the one hand, I have some ambitions to fulfill certain things through my work. But I do feel very strongly about having a good work-life balance. So I'm also quite committed to working 4 days a week, which is what I do, and to being, to kind of having a healthy lifestyle and to going back to France as much as I can and, you know, doing as many things I can do with either my daughter or my sister. And for me, and I think through COVID, and sorry to bring up the pandemic, we're all kind of sick of hearing about it, but I think that's been this, you know, despite some ups and downs, which many people have been through over the last couple of years. I think that's been one of the things that has helped me, is that I really am quite good at saying it's the end of the day now. I shut down my laptop and I walk out of my office and I walk away from work. I think that's been incredibly important. And I think you do your job better, actually. You don't necessarily do anyone a service if you just work longer hours at something, yourself or your employer. So I think for me, knowing that I need that balance has been really important as I get into my 50s. And the next steps for me really are a professorship, and that's what I'll be working towards over the next couple of years, which probably means some funding, and probably means writing another book and you know, creating some other work, which for me will be around learning and teaching in an arts, design, media faculty, essentially. So it kind of comes back to what I've always done. And that's where, maybe that's where the thread is for me, that ultimately I'm always interested in the arts, and I've probably always done some level of teaching in some ways. So writing about that and thinking about what does that mean in a current context, and what does that mean in the context of the very precarious work that we do, which is very much woven into my research, that theme of precarity and some of the inequalities that come from that. And that's where I'm at with my research and my career, really.
Yeah, indeed. There you mentioned a number of topics again. Had we had more time, we would have delved into as well. But I think within a short span of time, we touched upon a number of elements, and you really sort of rounded off all that very nicely by reflecting on sort of the fact that one can pace oneself, not sort of rush through a number of steps, but also sort of get used to and let the context and the environment grow on oneself, and therefore that way also sort of build a certain element of understanding that then one can share back with one's community. So, Annette, thank you very much for sharing your professional and also personal experiences with us, and also for music, which was also very good. So thank you once again, Annette.
You're very welcome. This was really interesting. Nice chance to reflect. Thank you.
Nittama l-intervista mal mistidna kija jellum Dr. Annette Modam mill-City University ta' Birmingham, Ingilterra. Uġbitkom, nistedinkom terġaw t-naqdu miħaj iġumadjela program juħu fissensiela minn campus għal-jħor.